This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
This is the Sports Edge with Rick Wolf on your flagship station for New York sports. The Fan, Sports Radio 66 and 101.9 FM, WFAN, New York.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Rick Wolf's Sports Edge. I am your host, Rick Wolf. You know, over the last few months, we have covered the pandemic and how it's affected youth, high school, and college athletes from just about every angle imaginable. But it suddenly dawned upon me that even though we have spoken with lawyers, coaches, educators, athletic directors, and even a number of the athletes themselves, we really haven't spoken to a medical expert who has been on the front lines in the battle of treating patients with COVID. And, you know, I felt compelled to do this morning because of a recent article I read in the New York Times about how some top collegiate and pro athletes were concerned about their heart health due to COVID. Now, we all know about the underlying health issues when it comes to coronavirus and how that makes individuals more susceptible to being infected. And worries about a heart disease called myocarditis have surfaced recently. And when I read about this, I immediately decided to reach out to Dr. Franklin Zimmerman, one of the top cardiologists in the country, and someone who is well aware of the relationship between athletics and health. And I should introduce Dr. Zimmerman. He's a senior attending cardiologist and director of cardiac rehabilitation at Phelps Memorial Hospital, Northwell Health in Sleepy Hollow, New York, in Westchester County. And Dr. Zimmerman, good morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you. Let's start with your own personal experience during the pandemic. I understand that you were in the trenches, in the front lines, in the hospital treating patients. And what was that like?
Well, I think it's pretty similar to just about what every healthcare professional would say in the region. We had a rough couple of months in March and April, and I have to give my extraordinary praise to the true frontline providers, the emergency room physicians, the hospitalists, the intensivists. We were all in it together, the nursing staff, EMTs, let's not forget our first responders, of course, our mm-hmm. police officers, EMTs, and firefighters, and they did an extraordinary job. What I think which was interesting throughout this is the cooperation of everybody on this, treating this crisis. So that was really, truly gratifying, and because it was really, really rough there for a couple of months. We did see, we have a community hospital in Phelps, but to sort of give you an example, we have a 12-bed ICU, and we eventually peaked at between 30 and 40 ventilated patients, so we obviously had to really make some tremendous changes. Northwell did have a tremendous surge plan in place, and we cooperated with our other sister hospitals, and we were actually able to take some patients from New York City and Rockland, from all over the region. So it was really, really an example of medical cooperation.
All these stories, these horror stories we've heard about the difficulties in getting equipment and things like that, that was all true? You went through the same thing?
Well, thankfully, because Northwell saw this coming in our hospitals, we were able to have enough on hand. Now, they were in short supply, so they, frankly, give me an example, we had what was called a mask manager to get our N95 masks to avoid any chance of hoarding. And you would go in, you'd literally sign your name and be distributed a mask. So, thankfully, Rick, we did not run out of PPE any material like that. And we needed them, for sure. We needed them. So we did not. They were in short supply, Rick, but we never ran out.
Okay, but let me ask you this. I mean, I have always assumed that COVID was primarily related to respiratory issues and the lungs and not the heart. So as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I was reading about myocarditis. And first of all, what is myocarditis? And why is this a concern? How is this related to COVID infections?
Yeah, that's a very good question there. This sounds like a joke, but it's not. You know, the heart bone is related to the lung bone. So there is a relationship. Just to step back a little bit, yes, we did see cardiac involvement. But to answer your question specifically first, myocarditis is a specific inflammatory condition of the heart, meaning, you know, itis, inflammation, arthritis, et cetera.
Right.
So it is a specific inflammation of the virus of the heart. Now, that is actually quite rare, and that's, I assume that's one of the things you'll would like me to speak about. Now,
yes.
Cardiac involvement is about 20 to 30% cardiac injury in these COVID patients. Any serious infection of the lung, and these patients, remember, these are hospitalized or ICU patients, they're gravely ill. And we see this in all types of systemic infections, severe pneumonias, that there's some leak of what we call troponin, which is a chemical which is an enzyme and protein that is leaked out of the heart when there is injury. Now, importantly, myocardial injury and myocarditis are two different things. Now, what's that mean? The example I will give you is that a skull fracture and a concussion are both head injuries,
mm-hmm.
but they're very different. So, myocardial injury, which is fairly common, 20 to 30%. In fact, there was a study from Sinai that just came out of hospitalized patients from Mount Sinai, New York, 36%. So it's a fair amount of involvement. And we did see that at our community hospital. We saw heart failure and cardiac dysfunction. But again, as you correctly state, COVID is primarily a pulmonary infection with systemic manifestations.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you specifically, and again, bring this back to the world of sports and the athletes in particular. Eduardo Rodriguez, the lefty pitcher for the Boston Red Sox, he came down with COVID over the course of the summer and then was shut down for the entire season because doctors had diagnosed him with myocarditis. And I, you know, that made some headlines a little bit, but I was wondering, is that just rare? Is it happening? Because Rodriguez had said that doctors had told him that 10 to 20% of all individuals who contract COVID also end up contracting myocarditis.
And yeah, I think that's a misstatement there. He did appear to have true myocarditis. I was reading his story. Obviously, I'm not treating him.
Yeah.
But what he had a fairly severe case of COVID. Quote, he never felt worse than this in his whole life. And then he recovered and then was back on the field, and he had some persistent symptoms. And this is where I think that the chance of myocarditis goes up. He had some, you know, 80% of all COVID-19 patients have minimal or no symptoms, or very minimal symptoms. You know, they're not hospitalized, about 80%.
Yep.
And he had moderate symptoms. He was not hospitalized. And then a couple of weeks later, he was back on the field, Rick, and he felt breathless, he didn't feel right, and he went appropriately to his team physicians, and they checked him, I believe, with an echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound of the heart, and found some dysfunction. Again, I'm not privy to the exact details, of course. And then they said, okay, I'm making an assumption that he had some cardiac dysfunction, and that is a diagnosis of myocarditis, meaning that the heart had been directly injured. Now, when you see that, those patients have to be shut down because they're at risk for severe complications, even sudden death.
Friends, we're talking with Dr. Franklin Zimmerman, the noted cardiologist, and I realize this is serious stuff, but obviously we've been talking about COVID for some time now, and we're looking at it now from the cardiac perspective. And then we'll open the phone lines, by the way, at 1-877-337-6666. Well, what about myocarditis? I mean, what is the prognosis? Do people get better from this? How serious is this?
Yes, it can be very serious. You can have severe, and other viral illnesses do this. You can have severe dysfunction leading to the need for heart transplantation. Now, thankfully, that is extremely rare because viruses are ubiquitous in our environment where, we get infected with viruses all the time. But thankfully, that is very rare. Now, he should make a complete recovery. Now, your question to whether what treatments are involved, that's difficult because we do not have specific treatments. For example, antibiotics against an infection that we have. We don't have powerful antiviral agents to say, okay, we're going to wipe out this infection and it's done, and then the heart will recover. So the treatment is supportive and allow the heart to try to recover. And supportive means treating any heart failure. Not all patients with myocarditis, which again is the inflammation, have true congestive heart failure from that heart dysfunction. So you treat that and give it time so the heart can recover. And that's why these patients are shut down 3 to 6 months, because if they do get myocarditis, premature return to sports can be with lethal consequences because the heart is irritable. We do see cardiac arrhythmias, meaning your regular heartbeats.
In his case, Rodriguez, he's 27, he's a big, strong guy, but they just said, no, there's obviously, it looks like there's a problem here. And he was, as you said, smart enough to say, I've been cleared to come back and compete and to pitch for the Sox, but then he didn't feel well. He just said, something's not right. And the doctors quickly diagnosed this as a myocarditis. What about younger people? He's 27, and we've heard over and over and over again that primarily the kids, high school kids, teenagers, kids that are college athletes in their early 20s, they may be asymptomatic even though they have COVID. What about, how concerned should parents, coaches, educators be in a situation where these kids are out competing and they may knowingly have concerns with their heart, with myocarditis?
I think the risk to a young person of cardiac involvement is extremely low, but that's not really the point. The point is the risk of infection is high, and we're seeing that across the country in kids going back to college, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That's where, and this is a moving target. Look what's going on across the country of kids going back to school. And I was actually speaking to my brother-in-law is a professor at North Carolina, and he was where they're actually at this point still playing ball. And he was he told me his experience is that the undergrads came back. They had a separate dorm for COVID positive students and a separate dorm to isolate their contacts. Well, in very short order, the contacts were overwhelmed. To summarize that point is that the risk of severe disease for a young person in COVID-19 is extremely low. Not zero. Look what we saw in the children, the Kawasaki's like situation just a month or so ago, which was devastating. But the risk of asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic infection, that's high. And remember, This is math. You get one infection infecting 2 to 3 other people. Well, you start doubling the rate of infection. Look exactly what we went through. And this thing explodes across the country. So infection rate in young people high, asymptomatic. And remember, they are going to transmit it to their older, whether it's coaches or teachers or other members of their family. That's the real risk there, for the young people. So we got to take this seriously.
And just to echo what you just said, you didn't say maybe or they possibly. You said they're going to transmit this disease to older people. As somebody who is obviously a cardiologist who does this every day and knows this turf so well. Clearly, you're concerned about this. You don't have the sense that this is going away soon, and that parents and coaches should be very concerned.
Absolutely. We cannot let down our guard. If their listeners take anything away from this, yes, the infection rate in New York State, thanks to the draconian measures, some say, that were put in place, guess what? They work. They absolutely work. Again, we don't, but there's a lot of very smart people and terrific companies that are working on antivirals and vaccines, of course. But right now, we don't have much. We have supportive care. And we sure as heck don't want to go through what we did just a couple of months ago. Remember history. I mean, there were three yep. waves of the 18-19 influenza pandemic. We can't have that. And the good news is that these relatively simple protective measures work. We early on, people got infected. One of my partners got it. With nurses at Phelps Hospital got it. They're back to work. Everyone's back. One of my receptionists got it. And now, thankfully, we're all doing the right thing. And knock on wood, the infection rate is very, very low. But no, we cannot let down our guard.
We're talking this morning with Dr. Franklin Zimmerman, cardiologist at Phelps Hospital in Westchester County. And I do want to talk a little bit about, obviously, what happened 100 years ago with the Spanish flu pandemic, because there are some parallels there. And, of course, we will take calls at 1-877-337-6666. Let me take a timeout. When I return, we'll go right to the calls. Stay with me. Back here on the Sports Edge, we're talking this morning with noted cardiologist Dr. Franklin Zimmerman about heart risks to athletes, obviously at all ages, but we're going to focus a bit here on high school and college athletes when it comes to COVID and heart concerns. And we're going to take your calls, of course, at 1-877-337-6666. Let's start off with Rob over in Lake Success. Hey, Rob, good morning. You're on the Fan.
Hey, Rick. Always a pleasure. Me and Coach Jack are texting away, and this is great. Doctor, I happen to be a podiatrist and was on the front line, as well as I did get the virus, one of the earlier people. Mm-hmm. My symptoms were the cough. I had a sore throat. Initially, I had a low-grade fever, and I thought it was the flu, got checked for the flu. It came up negative and just had this wacky, dry cough. Which lasted for 2 weeks, and I'm almost 60 years old. But the thing that made me a little different, that I always overcame it so quickly, was I'm a distance runner, and I actually trained. Once the fever broke, I trained through it, and I think that helped me get through the virus. I'm doing great. The only thing I will say is, on your end, atrial fibrillation, which is something as distance runners we can get, and kids as well as athletes can maybe possibly have to look into that. Is this something that the kids should be aware of as well, you know, if they do contract it? I know everybody talks about the kids, you know, it can not be as bad or more of a benign disease, but a lot of kids are getting sick. On your end, is this something you're concerned with, that the young ones can get this condition from the virus?
Yeah, that's a good question. By the way, I'm glad you're feeling better. Thank goodness.
I'm doing great. I mean, yeah. I'm going out for a run after Rick's show is over, but I always have to tune in, you know. But anyway.
Good for you. I'm sure you take good care of your feet there. Yeah, running in good shoes. But of all kidding aside, you are correct. We saw a lot of atrial fibrillation, but it wasn't in the young people, doctor. We saw atrial fibrillation in the patients, you know, again, the joke, the heart bone's connected to the lung bone. So when any time there's an acute pulmonary illness, the heart, of course, is irritable, and we saw a lot of atrial fibrillation. Now, you also bring up another point, just which is a different topic, that yes, athletes, long distance runners, atrial fibrillation is quite common. A number of NBA basketball players have atrial fibrillation, the number of pro baseball players, but yes, the distance sports. That's a subject regarding cardiac remodeling in athletics. But But you are absolutely correct. We saw a lot of arrhythmias. Now, whether that was a manifestation of specific cardiac injury or was it related to the general lack of oxygen from the pulmonary infection, we don't know.
One last question I want to ask you, for going with me as well as other athletes that are going to potentially get this virus, because it's just still out there and people are not taking it, I think, across the country serious. We are in New York. The fact that I had this, I'm wondering, potentially fibrosis of the lungs, okay? Now, I don't really feel it when I'm finished, you know, after the illness passed. I was having some blood in my sputum, and I was concerned about that, and I know runners can get that. But I don't usually get that, okay? Is this something, are you finding fibrosis in the lungs as well on some of these elderly patients? And should the kids be aware and take this much more seriously?
Yeah, that is one of the concerns. But it really was in our most ill patients that, when you look at the CT scans, they were a mess. I mean, thank goodness you didn't have that, but because you weren't sick enough, thank goodness, and recovered. But in our sickest patients, yes, we are seeing some patients that are having some persistent shortness of breath, and you have to make the assumption that they are going to have some fibrosis. You know, scar, that was the after the initial inflammation that there was lung scarring. Now, hopefully it's not debilitating, but you are correct. We are seeing that.
Hey, Rob, good questions, not surprisingly. Thank you for checking in this morning. It's greatly appreciated. Let's move on. Let's go to Frank in Astoria. Frank, good morning. You're next up on the fan.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I would just like to say that I can never prove in that I had COVID. It was back in November. I had one of the symptoms, which is I'd never had this in my life. It's the tingling and the paralyzation of your tongue and your mouth. And for the first time in my life, I couldn't taste food. I could only swallow food because I knew I had to eat or else I would get sick. And the fever that curtailed it was severely high. In past years, you know, I would have the flu and my mother would prepare a penicillin formula. But for this time, I decided not to take the penicillin formula. And somehow the fever, which is 100 and 203, dissipated. But I couldn't prove it. It's November of 2019. And the only person, it's not a person, it's a feline. It's a cat friend of my alumnus from high school would jump on my bed and would purr very loudly, because it's a hermaphrodite cat, would scream and say that, you know, because when cats scream real loud, they're probably indicating that maybe you're going to die, you pass on. We don't know why cats sometimes meow in certain ways, but it was terrible because I've never had those types of symptoms.
Frankly,
I just want to tell the doctor, you know, high school students, they don't have nurses that can actually, because I came from the Catholic High School Athletic Association. Do they treat in different school environments this a problem in a different way? Because I do know what asymptomatic symptoms are. They carry.
Chime in to answer a little bit. I'm not a primary care physician, so I won't comment on that. But just to say that what we do know is that the virus was not detected in this. It started in, you know, in China, Wuhan, China, in December. That is the ostensibly the start of it, and it did not arrive in this country till a month or so later. It went to Europe, of course, first. So I have no doubt that you had some form of viral illness, but it was very unlikely that that was COVID.
Yeah. Frank, thank you for checking in this morning, and hope that you're feeling better. Interesting that your cat or your friend's cat was able to sort of diagnose this concern. Before we get back to the calls, Dr. Zimmern, I do want to mention that you wrote a terrific piece, a different column about the healing power of baseball that ran in the New York Times, and you drew comparisons between the Spanish flu epidemic back in 1918 and with today. And friends, if you haven't seen the piece, I urge you to just Google it. Just Google the healing power of baseball, and you'll find it right away. But my question, Dr. Zimmern, is the fact that most people today don't seem to realize or acknowledge the fact that it took not just a few months, but it took 3 years to get through the Spanish flu back then, and that face masks were the main deterrent back then, as they are today, and social distancing. But from what I've read about the Spanish flu back then, and people, particularly in cities like Boston and Philadelphia, where we're especially hit hard, the mayors would come out after a few months and say, well, we finally have basically flattened the curve, and you're free not to wear masks again, and within a month, everybody was sick again. What are the lessons can we learn from that? And maybe you said before the break that, you know, social distancing and face masks, maybe these are simple requests. Maybe they're too simple for us to follow. Maybe we just don't take it seriously enough.
I think there's two great points there. Even before getting to the history, I want to make, and thank you, I want to make one real easy concept for people to understand. Think of, you know, I love to use analogies because, you know, people, and cliches, because they're easy to remember. And but thinking about this virus, it depends upon how much virus you're exposed to and for how long. So think about this. It's almost as if you had a can of spray paint. You know, if you're infected, you've got a can of spray paint. And you have someone who's on the other side of your lawn, and you could be spraying all day long, and they're unlikely, not impossible, but they're unlikely to get sprayed with paint. Now, if you got 10, if you and 10 other people got in an elevator and you had that spray paint, just about everybody's going to get hit with a lot of that paint.
Mm-hmm.
So the greater, the more time, the closer you are, the more time you spend, the more likely you're going to get it. And if somebody put a mask or a piece of cloth in front of that spray can, well, think about it. This is not a difficult concept. It's less likely you're going to get sprayed with paint. And here's the difference of this analogy, though. You're in that elevator. You don't know who's got the can of spray paint. So when people are thinking, should I wear the mask, should I not? Wear the mask. Try not to get sprayed with paint. Now, part two of your question, so I hope people can take that away a bit, is to think about how to wear their mask and why social distancing works. Now, the analogy, the comparison between 1918 and now is unbelievable. And I would encourage some people, if you have not read the New York Times bestseller, The Great Influenza by John Barry, please do so. Fellow Brown alum, by the way. And also, you went up to you went to another college up the road called Harvard, Rick. I know.
Yeah.
And Skip Desjardins also wrote a terrific book called September 1918: War, Plague, and the World Series, which are great books. The parallels. The reason I like history a bit, and a buddy of mine, Alan Railsberg, sent me a picture from the National Baseball Hall of Fame, of a picture of from an exhibition game in Pasadena, California, where the umpire and the batter and the catcher were all wearing masks, as were those watching the grandstand. And I said, this is interesting. So I investigated. Went back and read those books and did some research. And then I sort of made the comparisons. Remember at the time, back in May, we didn't have any sports at all. And we were in the middle of this lockdown. And frankly, I think it was affecting psychologically. That's some of your expertise, Rick. I know that the people were sort of confined to quarters. And it was affecting not only their physical health, but their mental health. So I made comparisons of how important sports and baseball in particular are to the American psyche. And it's not simply just a game. It's important.
No question. I think we all feel the same way, and that's why we're so eager to return to a sense of normalcy, to return to the so-called good old days of watching kids go out and compete and play team sports. But yes, we have to do it within the parameters of making sure that we basically corral this virus. I mean, just this past week, a high school athletic director in Utah, He literally stopped a high school football game until everybody in the stands put on a mask, and they had to sit in seats that were at least 6 feet apart.
Wow!
And I was good for the AD to have the courage, to try and protect the fans who didn't seem to think that the rules of safety applied to them. And he was dead serious. He got on the PA and said, "Look, we're going to stop the game right now until everybody you got to put your mask on and you got to sit away from everybody, or we're not going to continue." And they waited until people basically complied. I think we're going to see more of those kind of play stoppages at the high school level as the year begins around here, as schools start playing sports again. But, you know, it's just so strange to me, even now, as I walk around where I live and I see kids still playing travel baseball or softball, lacrosse, whatever, soccer, and I don't see any social distancing or masks at all. And it's just like, come on, folks. Do you think somehow you are not susceptible to getting this disease? It's just very, very strange and very frustrating.
You couldn't be more right. You know, again, a cliche, you know, denial is not just a river in Egypt.
Yeah.
And people, it doesn't hurt. You know, you can't see the spray paint. You know, it's a silent killer. And again, you know, I tell people, I said, look, again, I'm using a lot of cliches and analogies because I hope people remember it. They said, if there's a dam that's leaking upstream, I tell people, don't wait until your feet get wet to move to higher ground. It's too late.
It's too late.
So start early. And this is, look, here's what's frustrating to me as a physician and as a person. We didn't have a chance to intervene. This thing hit us in March like a ton of bricks. This thing was upon us, and we had to deal with all the consequences. What I don't understand across the country is that other areas of the country saw what we went through in New York and have chosen not to learn the lesson.
It's unbelievable. It's just mind-boggling. Like, What were you guys not paying attention? You think this is all a hoax? You think it's made up? It's just nuts. All right, let me take a time out here. We're talking this morning, obviously, about COVID and what parents and coaches and educators should know about this when it comes to kids and sports in particular. We're talking with Dr. Franklin Zimmerman, the noted cardiologist. Let me take a time out. When I return, we'll go back to the calls at 1-877-337-6666. I invite you to check out my website at AskCoachWolf.com. You can follow me on Twitter at #AskCoachWolf. We're talking this morning with Dr. Bud Zimmerman, one of the nation's top cardiologists, about COVID and related issues to one's heart. And friends, if you missed the first part of the show, I would definitely suggest you go back and listen to it. You can go to WFAN.com and listen to the podcast, because this is important stuff here, to be sure. We're taking your calls at 1-877-337-6666. I sort of know the answer to this question, but I need to ask it anyhow before we get back to our callers. Clearly, if you're a sports parent and you're trying to decide right now whether or not you let your kid go back and play at the high school level or modified school level or travel team, Dr. Zimmerman, what would you advise to them?
I think that it really depends on the sport. There are the low-risk sports, and these are easy. You know, the golf and tennis, the answer is yes. That's easy to maintain the social distancing, and again, you're managing the risk here. Baseball, if you do everything right, that would be considered a moderate risk sport.
Mm-hmm.
The football, basketball, wrestling, those are the tough ones. You know, and they're struggling with this at the high school, certainly, and they're struggling with the collegiate and professional level. Now, the pros are, you know, they can really mandate what their teams do. Colleges, their students, ostensibly students first, athletes second, and their students will be students. If they did everything right, I think they could probably be pretty safe.
We know with obviously the NBA and the NHL being in a bubble, but they have deep pockets to do that.
Right.
We've seen the collegiate, you know, the Big Ten, the Pac-12, they have money too, but they obviously have decided, no, we don't take that chance. We're not going to take that risk. At the high school level, nobody has the wherewithal to do all the daily testing that the pros do. So this is just very curious. And as I said, we see a lot of kids who play travel sports, and I just don't see a lot of mask or social distancing. I just see kids playing sports like it was good old days.
Yeah, I think that's a problem. I really do. And, you know, as much as we want our kids to play sports and have a good time and have a wonderful high school and middle school experience, again, looking back through history, when my father was 17, he was on a troop ship, and people were, they were 18, they were trying to kill him. Let's put it in perspective. If we miss a travel season for people, for our children and the adult safety, so be it.
Yep. I hear you. Let's continue with our calls. And I think that's well said. Sometimes, you know, the fact is you got to put things in priority. Somebody has to make a grown-up decision here. And I said, look, I'm sorry, but it just for the safety and health and welfare of you and your peers and friends, I'm sorry. It may be that we're just not going to be able to play sports this year. It's as simple as that. It's horrible to say, horrible to think about, but it really is something that we have to realize that we're looking at the numbers continue to rise. The death rate continues to rise around the country, and not just with older people, but with younger people as well. It's getting to be very, very scary. Let's go to Jack Smithlin over in Fairlawn. I'm curious to get Jack's thoughts about our conversation this morning. Jack?
How are you, Rick and Dr. Zimmerman? It's great listening to you. And you know, I'm like every Sunday morning, I'm sitting here watching a softball game, and like Rick mentioned, there's nobody wearing masks, there's nobody social distancing, you know, and in order to do the thing safe, like you said, Dr. Zimmerman, we have to, and Dr. Rob, you know, tells me the same thing, and, you know, he texts me the same thing, and I agree, we have to be responsible, but we're not being responsible. I mean, I'm watching a game right now. Nobody's wearing a mask. Nobody's social distancing. The kids are sitting right on a bench together. It's just amazing on that we're taking so many chances with this virus. But reading a little bit and studying and being a health teacher for over 44 years, you know, this disease is something that I believe, and I might be wrong, but the inflammation of the heart or even the arteries and veins around the heart can cause scar tissue to build up. And once scar tissue is built up, there's only one way of removing it, and that's surgery. So that's a long-term, you know, a life. It'll stay with you for life, which causes the heart to work harder and has to beat faster in order to get the same amount of blood and oxygen through the body. So this is a disease that, even though it might not hit you in a way that shows all these signs, it will be something that will last, you know, the rest of your lifetime. Is that a true statement, Doc?
You are correct. Thankfully, cardiac involvement is infrequent, you know, severe cardiac involvement. Now, we did see it primarily in our hospitalized patients and in our ICU patients and our patients on ventilators, the most severe, that's where the cardiac involvement, and frankly, we had a high death rate in those patients. Now, for better or for worse, they were elderly. In our own practice, the patients that we lost, it was terrible, but they were patients in their 80s and 90s. Those are the ones we lost. Germane to Rick's show is in sports parenting, thankfully, that cardiac involvement is very, very rare in a young person. But, again, asymptomatic transmission, and it can happen. And again, Eduardo Rodriguez, he got it, and he's done for the season. And there, as I read, there were a couple of other ball players, some Georgia Tech quarterback and another I think it was Indiana, lineman was affected and was quite ill.
Yep.
Is that not right, Rick? And so it can affect. And thankfully, it's rare, but it's not zero. So you know what? Think about this. If you're a parent and you're sitting at a game right now, hope you have a mask on, by the way, if you're sitting at a game, and to let those kids play, let them sit apart from each other with masks on, and we as parents have responsibility as parents and coaches and teachers. Put your mask on, because these social distancing and masks, they work.
Yeah, it's such a simple I don't want to say a universal solution, but certainly it's something that we all know and have been drilled every day for several months. And Jack, thank you for the call this morning. Always appreciate it. The fact is that we have to do this, and particularly now as school is on the horizon and kids are going back and thinking about playing team sports. I mean, I know the CDC and the National Federation of High Schools put out their guidelines about which sports are low risk, which ones are medium, which ones are high risk, and clearly football is a high risk sport for obvious reasons. But I would also put, I know they said soccer and basketball were sort of medium risk, but I'm thinking, geez, I don't know how that is. I mean, soccer, you're running, you're marking your player, you're breathing on each other's face, you're contact. I mean, how can that be just a medium risk sport? And the same with basketball. If you're guarding a player and you're close to them, it just seems that we want to be very, very cautious about this. And I just don't. If the idea is to protect ourselves, that this seems the obvious way to do this. Put the mask on, you know, keep social distance, and go from there. Dr. Zimmerman, what do you think about all this?
And, you know, absolutely. As we mentioned a few minutes ago, if there, I mean, I'm a huge sports fan, and I'd love to watch the game, but if we have to make some adjustments that are painful and nuisances, you know, again, so be it. You know, going back through history, remember, Rick and I, you and I were talking a little bit. You know, the 1919 Stanley Cup was not played, was not completed. You look on the Stanley Cup, and both teams are listed there. So they had to make a decision because the players were, now none of us were around then, but the players were devastated. They're all homesick and in hospitals. They could not complete the Stanley Cup. Football games, they played in 18 and 19, they played a fraction, college. They played a fraction of the normal schedule.
It's just surprising to me that people don't come back to these and say, you understand this happened before and we had to make sacrifices, and people, athletes lost perhaps a year of their best athletic prowess because of the Spanish flu. But the good news is that they were able to go back and play a year or two later. And they weren't dead. I mean, that's the reality of it. And we, you know, we keep hearing Dr. Fauci talk about there might be a spike again come the winter, especially as the flu comes around. I mean, it's just like, friends, let's be realistic here. This may not happen. Nobody wants to be the bearer of bad news, but this is what we're looking at. Let's continue on with our calls. Let's go to Ron up in Connecticut. Hey, Ron, good morning. You're next up on the fan.
Good morning. I don't want to take a lot of time. My question is this. What about wearing gloves when you go to the different gyms and places like that? How does the virus get down on the surface or something, not only through the air, but do you pick it up from not wearing gloves? I'll listen to your comments.
Yeah,
thank you.
Question. Thanks, Ron. Doc, what about that? I mean, we know early on people were saying you had to wear gloves and masks, and now we see that gloves still is suggested, but not as it was before. And then there's always the debate about how long the virus lasts on surfaces and that kind of thing.
Yeah, again, not being an expert in this, but I will say this: if you wash your hands, that's fine. I don't wear gloves. Some people do. Some of the docs in our offices do. I do not. But I wash my hands before I see the patient, after I see the patient, many times during when I see the patient, and the way it gets from a surface to your hands is by touching, obviously, and then the way it gets into your respiratory tract is because you touch a mucous membrane, you touch your nose, you touch your put your fingers to your mouth somehow, or your eyes, then it gets into the system. So if you're wearing a glove, it would be on the glove. You'd have to take the gloves off before mm-hmm. you touched anything. So the answer to the question, in my view, is that gloves are not necessary, but hand hygiene is.
Yeah, and I think, again, we know we've been through this a lot for several months. People are just obviously getting fatigued and weary, but clearly these are essential and important aspects of personal hygiene to protect oneself and basically one's kids as well. I mean, it's as simple as that. We have to be... Let's face it, we have to be responsible about this. Otherwise, it's just going to continue on. Let's go quickly to Louis in Lindbrook. Hey, Louis, good morning. You're on the fan.
Hey, Rick. Great speaking with you. Dr. Zimmerman, great show today.
the colleges now, I've been coaching college soccer and lacrosse for over 30 years. The colleges now are telling the students to come back to college.
Yep.
Once they arrive there, now they're telling them to go back home.
Yep.
And my question is, this is what I believe. I believe everything is a high risk if you don't wear a mask. But my question to you today is this. Should our athletes sit out until a vaccine is available for COVID? What's your opinion?
Good question. Thanks, Lou. What do you think, Doctor?
Well, you know, that's a public health decision. It would be, I think it'd be presumptuous for me to make a broad statement
mm-hmm.
like that, because it every situation is different. The way those decisions are made is by, again, depending, is basing it on the risk of infection. If you've got an extraordinarily low risk in your college, your town or state, and remember, students come from all over. So that's what's a very difficult situation. A local school might be able to make a decision if they could guarantee that the students practice proper social distancing. The problem has been is that the practice has not followed through with the theory. The theory was great that they come back and do everything, and look what we're seeing. So the caller is asking the question, if everybody did everything right, maybe. But here's the facts on the ground. Nobody's
yep.
doing everything. Not nobody, but a large percentage of our students are not doing everything right. So we're paying the consequences. So that's why it's a tough decision.
And as we unfortunately, we're running out of time here. And friends, we are talking with Dr. Franklin Zimmerman, a senior attending cardiologist, director of cardiac rehabilitation at Phelps Memorial Hospital, Northwell Health in Sleepy Hollow up in Westchester County. So as we wrap this up, I'm just curious, what are your thoughts? What do you see? What's going to happen this fall in terms of sports, kids, and this whole virus? What's your instinct on this?
My instinct is that this is going to be a this season is going to be one that's unique, unlike any other. But and I think things are going to get canceled. I think in small situations, it can be very successful. Frankly, we've shown that in New York, and we can beat down this virus with if people are doing the right things. I don't think, this has been a failure of leadership, that it's going to be a big problem across this country, for the next number of months. That may change. But I am enthusiastic and encouraged and frankly impressed. Vaccines usually take a long time, but I think we are going to have one more than one vaccine, because they're targeting different aspects of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to find out which one. And frankly, you say, how could that be? Well, you can think back, the first shingles vaccine was good and the next one was better. So people were getting both. So this is, you know, people should think back, I may need more than one vaccine. I don't know yet whether we're going to need to get a coronavirus vaccine every year. If that's the case, so be it. I'm all in. I think that, when they get despondent, I do tell them this. I say, look, you know, humans, we're resilient. And the Black Death in the Middle Ages was followed by the Renaissance. 1919 was followed by the Roaring Twenties. We're going to get through this both medically and socially. I have great confidence of that.
Well,
but that may take the spring.
I hear you. Dr. Zimmerman, I just want to personally salute you and thank you for all the difficult and dangerous work you've done to save lives during this pandemic. And, of course, I very much thank you for coming on this morning to share your insights. And, again, I thank you so much. We'll talk to you again real soon.
You bet. Always a pleasure.
That is Dr. Franklin Zimmerman. Okay, now, as I wrap up this week, I want to pay tribute to my longtime friend and colleague in the world of sports parenting. Bob Bigelow passed suddenly a few days ago. If you don't know, Bob Bigelow was an all-Ivy, 6'7", sharp-shooting forward at Penn back in the mid-70s, was a first-round draft choice in the NBA, played several years in the league before retiring and then going back to school for an MBA. And I have to tell you, Bob was always in tip-top physical shape. He looked like he could easily handle himself at the age of 66 in a full-court basketball game. But he was recently diagnosed with some heart issues, and apparently he succumbed to a heart attack this past week. After playing in the NBA and in a great business career, Bob became a passionate advocate when it came to kids and sports. He did thousands of sports parenting presentations over the years. And if you ever heard him and his booming baritone voice, you know how absolutely passionate he was about how we need to confront and change parental perceptions in the world of sports. Along the way, he authored two books on the subject, Just Let the Kids Play and Youth Sports, Still Failing Our Kids and How to Really Fix It. They are both wonderful books, and they're very much worth the read. Bob Bigelow was survived by his wife, Nancy, the longtime head swimming coach at Tufts University, and their two sons, David and Stephen. I have to tell you, over the years, Bob has been on the Sports Edge many, many times. He was a true pioneer in this field, and his presence will be missed, seriously missed. He's just a tremendous loss to us all. Okay, that's going to do it for me in this edition of the Sports Edge this morning. My thanks to Ed Arzuman. Please stick around for Ed Randall. He is up next, and I'll see you next week right here on the Sports Edge.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.